throughout Clayton, bearing witness to the injustice that these young people have experienced and that this city and community has experienced. There will be action at people will be gathering at Keener Plaza at noon today, and a subsequent action, and there will be ongoing actions every day on every hour in this place for over 100 days. People have been in the street willing to put their bodies on the line, risking arrest, tear gas, pepper spray, because they are trying to keep alive the best of Democratic tradition.
Jelani Cobb, we have 10 seconds. Final comment.
The only thing that I can say is that this is Ferguson is America. That what happened here is not atypical. That this is a national problem and something that we all need to be mindful of. And we will see more Fergusons in the future.
There are helicopters flying overhead right now. We're standing in front of what is known as the Justice Center, where the grand jury said no indictment. That's right. They refused to indict Officer Darren Wilson for the killing of Mike Brown, an 18-year-old African-American teenager, August 9, 2014. That does it for our broadcast from Ferguson and Clayton. I want to thank our guests, Osagie Sifo Sekou, pastor of the First Baptist Church in Jamaica Plain, as well as Jelani Cobb and Vince Warren, and special thanks to our team. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:01. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon, committed to helping 17,000 vulnerable people of all ages in our community live better lives each year. You can learn how to help by visiting the website at voaor.org.
Thanksgiving is a time to give thanks. But for many, the problematic history of the creation of this holiday casts a shadow on what Thanksgiving is supposed to represent. On Thanksgiving morning, on KBOO, we bring you Indigenous Voices on a Colonial Holiday. Tune in from 8 a.m. to noon for a series of special public affairs programs, including a conversation with local activist and founding member of Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, Jacqueline Keeler. We will also hear the voices of Dr. David Lewis and Dr. Michael Yellowbird. We'll talk about history, politics, education, food, and how to decolonize Thanksgiving.
A professional living, how can money justify the greed?
Tuesday nights on KBOO, it's Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush.
With DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid.
10 p.m. to midnight.
2 hours of global bass featuring Bhangra, Bollywood,
and the urban sounds of the global diaspora.
You're done north.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Ferguson, and we'll have a live report from Paul Rowland at the protest in downtown Portland.
More police shootings in Cleveland, Ohio, and Brooklyn, New York.
And in Mexico, authorities are cracking down on protests over the murder of 43 students. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 25th, 2014. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Jared Dantzler.
The verdict is in Ferguson. We begin this newscast with a report from WBAI.
From WBAI in New York, an update in the aftermath of the Michael Brown grand jury report. I'm Don DeBar.
All 12 jurors were present for every session, and all 12 jurors heard every word of testimony and examined every item of evidence. They were instructed on the law and presented with five indictments ranging from murder in the first degree to involuntary manslaughter. Their burden was to determine, based upon all of the evidence, if probable cause exists to believe that a crime was committed and that Darren Wilson is the person who committed that crime. After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the five indictments.
That was Robert McCulloch, the St. Louis County prosecuting attorney, Monday, after the grand jury considering his presentation regarding the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, declined to indict the police officer who killed him, Darren Wilson. President Barack Obama went to the airwaves shortly after the grand jury's report was made public.
As all of you know, a few minutes ago, the grand jury deliberating the death of Michael Brown issued its decision. It's now come that either way was going to be subject of intense disagreement, not only in Ferguson, but across America. So I just want to say a few words suggesting how we might move forward. First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully.
Many questions surfaced immediately after the announcement, and there were still more questions raised after the release of a transcript of part of the grand jury proceedings. After the news was released, attorney Patrice Salton spoke with RT America.
What was interesting to me was the explanation of the facts that were presented to the grand jury, right? So if the issue was what degree of homicide should they charge here, then really what they have to decide is whether there was justification for the way that the officer acted. We didn't hear anything about the description of the perpetrator that he was looking for having a weapon. We didn't hear anything about Michael Brown presenting a weapon or making any threatening statements or doing anything that would cause an officer or a person exercising reasonable care to fire 12 shots at an unarmed black teenager. I mean, all we heard was that he turned around toward the officer, perhaps started moving toward him, and that there was a lethal response. And so it's unusual, or I guess it's difficult to understand how the jury would not at least return an indictment for involuntary manslaughter, which only requires a reckless action on behalf of Officer Wilson. And so I think that the evidence of 60 witnesses, which is quite unusual, had to have been presented to the jury in a way that that was designed to get that outcome. So the concern is, again, the equal protection of the law aspect of this, because what prosecutors generally do when they're trying to establish just probable cause is to put on an officer and maybe one other witness so that they can make sure that they bring an indictment on the highest charge possible. And then as they continue their investigation, whether they have help from the federal authorities or not, they can ratchet the charges down if they want to, but they can't really ratchet them back up later as easily. And so generally they put on an officer. The officer will say, you know, I talked to a witness and this is what the witness said happened. You know, this person was shot 12, you know, this officer shot at someone 12 times when there was no lethal threat presented, and will you please return an indictment for murder one? And they didn't do that in this case, and it does sound calculated. I think that they presented a lot of physical evidence, a lot of expert testimony that you generally wouldn't see, because that goes into sort of, you know, whether there was justification or not, as opposed to whether there was probable cause. We're not really at the affirmative defense stage or figuring out whether there was reasonable doubt or challenging, you know, the veracity of what the witnesses had to say. We're just trying to establish, is it probable that a crime was committed here? This decision ends the investigation. And so if there's anything else that, you know, if there's any other forensic evidence that hasn't yet been presented, that opportunity is lost for the family.
As the news spread, demonstrations broke out across the country, from Boston to Los Angeles to Seattle to Washington, D.C., including a raucous rally outside the White House. In New York, one protester, Diego Ibanez, 26, was arrested for allegedly throwing fake blood on Police Commissioner Bill Bratton and an aide at a Times Square rally Monday night. Bratton was standing in the crossroads of the world as hundreds participated in a demonstration following the decision. Later, crowds of people marched on the Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Triborough bridges. Sarah Flounders from the International Action Center told us about a protest at Union Square.
Today, all out, 5 p.m., Union Square, and all across the country. I think there are more than 140 cities now where people in outrage are protesting the Ferguson decision. There'll clearly also be people marching, leaving Union Square as the crowd grows, and this is a time for everyone to come out in force to protest this outrageous, racist decision, which gives cops free and clear authority to kill.
The nation's reaction to the Darren Wilson acquittal continues to grow, with at least 164 protests taking place last night and throughout the day today. 14 hours after the controversial court decision acquitting Officer Darren Wilson for the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown, protests were being planned in across 37 states, Canada, Japan, and the United Kingdom included. Protests erupted in Ferguson minutes after the decision was announced, and one death has been confirmed so far. A 20-year-old in Ferguson died near the spot where Michael Brown was shot, but the circumstances of his death are still unknown. 13 people have been injured in the Ferguson area protests, and police have fired over 100 shots of live ammunition. In Oakland, 40 protesters were arrested after a peaceful march became unruly. Davey D, the host of Hard Knock Radio, was in Oakland last night as a freeway was shut down. Here's a segment of his report.
What we see is a large number of police, at least it looks like several dozen, that are blocking the entrance to 580. We also see a large crowd that are walking towards the freeway entrance. So we will see how this unfolds. Of course, people reacting to the verdict in Ferguson, the non-indictment of Darren Wilson, and I'm sure that the president's remarks didn't add too much to where people's heads are at with respect to his willingness to address Ferguson and tell people to be peaceful as he's allowed so many other places to go up. So we're here with the crowd of people that are in the middle of Grand and Grand Avenue in MacArthur, and we'll try to talk with folks to see where they're at and what their thoughts are on this situation. Police have surrounded everybody. You see the police cars all the way up on Grand Avenue. The police are also down on Lakeshore and blocking the freeway entrance. So that's what's happening right about now. We're here with Cephas Johnson and Selassie. Your thoughts on tonight and what's going on here right now?
Well, I mean, what's going on here right now? We have a bunch of people from Oakland that is angry and supporting the family of Mike Brown and speaking to this very injustice that we've seen happen today with the grand jury. I myself, personally, I'm angry and hurt and pain for the family first, but just most definitely the fact that this is system, as we know, it has, again, showed her just how unjust it is. And therefore, what I feel is that until we actually do something about it, we're going to continue to see the killings in this country like we're seeing on a regular basis.
I'm not sure if you were out here. Did you hear the President Obama's speech or did you hear the press remarks prior to that?
I did hear the prosecuting attorney read his statement on why the grand jury came back with the verdict they came back with. But I did not hear President Obama speak to the issue himself.
I hear that. Yeah, it was disappointing. Selassie, your thoughts on this?
Very disappointed and very hurt. Just very hurt and very disappointed and very scared to be a black man in America. You know, where every day I'm under attack already, but can definitely be killed by the police, and then the pig just walks off and gets off. That just is very scary, and I'm very hurt for Mike Brown's family and all the other brothers, brother Curly out there in New York as well, Akai Curly, and the little 12-year-old brother who got killed with the little pistol gun or
Cleveland,
whatever,
Ohio.
You know, in Cleveland, Ohio. So it's just continuing to happen, and I'm scared to be a black man, but I'm very optimistic and staying strong.
Ross Salome from the POCC, your thoughts on out here tonight. You don't seem surprised about the verdict?
Not at all, not at all. This is another example, you know what I mean, since the Dred Scott case in way back in 1857, you know what I'm saying, in St. Louis, Missouri, to right now out there in Ferguson, Missouri, with Mike Brown. It's another legal lynching, you know what I mean? It's been going on for 500 years of this white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, you know what I mean? It's a rotten system, and it exposed itself once again, and we in Oakland will stand in solidarity out here. We here out here with the people just saying that, you know what I mean, we ain't having it. You know, this is just one of many stages that you'll see us in. We engage the people to make real change or sustain revolution through different tactics. But we out here tonight in solidarity with Ferguson, you know?
What do you think needs to happen to change things around?
Man, we need an entire revolution, you know what I mean? Keep it real, it'll take too long to explain it right now in a soundbite, but revolution is the thing, man, complete change, because what's going on now is rotten and it's twisted and it's being set up, so until that can happen, you know what I mean?
A rally is being held right now in Portland in solidarity with the people of Ferguson, Missouri. The protest is at the Central Precinct Building at Southwest 3rd and Madison in downtown Portland. The rally is sponsored by the Albania Ministerial Alliance, a.k.a. the AMA, Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. The aim of the rally is to protest the grand jury decision made in Ferguson, which failed to indict the officer Darren Wilson for shooting an unarmed teenager, Michael Brown, in early August. Paul Rowland now joins us live. Hello, Paul. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Paul,
yeah,
what's
the... Here, okay. Oh, it's really, really loud. I have to move away a little more. There's a huge crowd down here. I don't know. There's 500, 600, 700, 800 people. It's they filled up the steps in front of the so-called Justice Center, and they've got the sidewalk, the street in front of the whole block filled, the park behind it. It's really high energy here, and there's people chanting, as you can hear in the background, I'm sure. And I'm here with John Mahumi, who's one of the organizers and one of the speakers, and I'm going to hand it over to him. And John, what was your message to the crowd here today?
Well, the message was one of the need for organization. One of the problems that takes place a lot in Portland is that there's a popular trend where people like to go to rallies and hoop and holler and then go have something to eat and have a beer or whatever people do and just wait for the next tragedy to happen. And we've got to understand, we've got to get the message to people that people have to engage. They have to get involved. They have to join organizations working for justice. So that was the message that the All African People's Revolutionary Party, who I'm representing, when we went up there, that was our message, is to tell people you've got to be involved in some organization working for justice.
And what parallels do you...
That was a JAMU, and we also have another, we have Nyung Howard here, who was actually in Ferguson. Nyung, tell us about some of your experiences there.
Okay, so my experience when I first went to Ferguson was just organizing at its lowest level, just people mobilizing over that tragic event that happened and just having a lot of emotion and just being together. That was good and all, but now when I turn on the TV and look up the organizations and see the movement and the growth of organizations, it makes me feel good to see how people are organized and really making some sustainable actions happen, shutting a lot of things down. Because without organization, we will never be able to move these folks out of our way.
And what parallels do you see between Ferguson and Portland?
Can you repeat that?
Sure. What parallels do you see between Ferguson and Portland?
Well, wherever we are, as Africans, you got the police, no matter what in the world. So that's going to connect us no matter what. And we're going to be oppressed. We're going to be going through the same economic conditions and education and health. And we're facing a whole lot of disparities, and people want to talk about equity. And so it's the same no matter where we are. We could be in the Caribbean right now or Peru, and African people everywhere are facing the same injustices from the capitalist, colonial, imperialistic police force.
And what would you say to people who argue that police reform doesn't come about by street protests?
Well, you know, with class suicide, we wouldn't need police. We wouldn't need... The police only protect the people who have from the people who have not. And that's what you get from classism. And you just got to rally. you got to stand up for something. Stand for something or fall for anything.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul, are you there?
Yeah.
Paul, what is the police presence like?
What's that?
What is the police presence like there?
They're not really strongly, kind of in the background, basically. You know, they basically let people take over the entire steps and sidewalk and the entire block. And yeah, they're not really making any strong presence. They're kind of on the sidelines. Mm-hmm.
And what type of signs are people holding?
Justice, rebellion is justified. Rebellion is justified. Support Mike Brown, hold police accountable, justice, police accountability, yeah, all kinds of stuff like that. No justice, no peace.
What has been the response of passersby?
Some of the what?
What has been the response of people walking by this protest?
Oh, been really overwhelming. Just there's a really high energy. Oh, walking by the protest. Well, I've been right in the middle of it, so I couldn't actually tell you that. But it seems like more and more people keep joining it.
That's great. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking live with protesters outside the Portland Police Central Precinct at Southwest 3rd and Madison.
Did Darren Wilson's prosecutor throw the case? While outrage erupts across the nation upon the announcement of the grand jury decision not to indict Officer Wilson and his role in the shooting of death of Michael Brown, focus now leads back to the head prosecutor himself. The unusual nature in which this case has been brought to the grand jury has led questions to the motivation of the St. Louis County prosecutor. Bob McCulloch has a conflicted past with this particular case, being the son of a slain police officer and his obvious connections to law enforcement. As the proceedings unfolded, McCulloch's loose grip on the case became evident, allowing the presentation of uninvestigated eyewitness testimony, the four-hour testimony of Darren Wilson, and no direct charge for the case is highly unusual in a grand jury trial. McCulloch's late announcement and explanation of the case further incites critics who believe he was acting more as a defense attorney for Wilson than a prosecutor. This leads us to question the motives of the man in charge of bringing this case to trial.
And now from death row, Mumia Abul-Jamal speaks out on Ferguson.
Ferguson. Like a fever, the news broke. But unlike a fever, it brought no relief. For the news, from the perspective of the national black community, wasn't good. The 12-member grand jury in Ferguson, investigating the killing of a black teenager, Mike Brown, returned with no true bill, legalese for no charges, no indictment, no case. Despite the fact that Brown was unarmed, no charge. The name Ferguson joins an ancient line of place names of pain, loss, and black death. Places like Birmingham, Philadelphia, and now Ferguson. It'll have a meaning all its own. For young people, many of whom are new to activism, who felt compelled to hit the streets in protest of unbridled police power and legalized impunity, the challenge will be how to continue. How to fight on, and even what the fight is. Some, brokenhearted, will flee this ugly episode and try, perhaps unsuccessfully, to seal such a memory away. Others will grow in radicalism, convinced that this case is the very epitome of racist injustice. But Ferguson may prove a turning point, a point in time when the nation chose the wrong road ahead. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abul-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for a weekly segment on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
Thank you. Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. There's a tremendous amount of economic privilege and white privilege in our community here in Portland. This privilege sometimes makes it really hard to remember that we are all living in a corporate state where it's difficult to figure out where our government ends and our large corporations begin. For example, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is run by an executive from Monsanto Corporation. Paulo Freire, the great Brazilian educator, long ago coined the term the unconscious oppressed to describe privileged people like us who forget how oppressed we really are. Today, the oppressive vehicle of choice is the global corporation, and we are the oppressed people. In my early years of work to dismantle corporate rule, my primary mentor was an amazing guy named Richard Grossman, who died a number of years ago. In a speech he gave, he talked about how you and I act like oppressed people. Here's the list of examples he cited. We adopt corporate values. We aspire to be like the most respectable of the corporate leaders. We model our civic, educational, and other institutions after the corporation. We accept the dominance and authority of the corporation as just and appropriate or as inevitable. We concede to corporations basic legal and cultural authority to define production, investment, and work, and to define basic values and concepts such as progress, sustainability, efficiency, productivity, justice, freedom, liberty, human rights, nature, property, peace, prosperity, public and private, and personhood. We pursue our grievances within institutions crafted by corporations. We allow corporations to educate and entertain our children. We fear governing ourselves and defining our own societies. We do not know our own history. We think and talk and strategize in the language of the corporate culture. We confuse freedom with the maintenance of the status quo. Paulo Freire refers to these characteristics as the unconscious oppressed. Were you surprised by your reactions to this list? Let's take a look at one item from the list. We model our civic institutions after the corporation. For example, when we set up nonprofit social change organizations, we replicate the business corporation structure almost without exception. In fact, if you want to create a nonprofit organization in this country, you are required to choose a president, secretary, and treasurer, which starts you on the path towards hierarchical decision-making. And if you want to raise lots of money for your group, you have to file for tax-exempt status. Major nonprofits have to raise tons of money from corporations simply to survive, and what happens next is inevitable. Just look at the Sierra Club, whose board of directors took millions of dollars from the so-called natural gas industry to launch its campaign against coal and then lied to its members about having taken the money. This is the inevitable outcome of nonprofit organizations choosing to suckle at the corporate teat, which is why, after the American Revolution, it was a felony crime if a corporation was found to have donated money or services to a civic or charitable organization. Because when we the people become financially dependent on donations from our business institutions, we lose our capacity to function as the sovereign people. Let's take another example from the list I just read. We pursue our grievances within institutions crafted by corporations. Did you know that when we pursue our grievances through a regulatory agency or regulatory hearing, we're standing on a corporate playing field following corporate rules? The entire regulatory system of law was designed by the railroad industry in cahoots with the U.S. Attorney General way back in the 1880s. For the purpose of insulating corporate activities from citizen opposition. No wonder we all feel so powerless when we're told to sit down and shut up after we get our 3 minutes to testify at a regulatory hearing. It is our activism itself that is now being regulated. Let's review one final example from the list I just read. We accept the dominance and authority of the corporation as inevitable. Why else would we work our asses off trying to raise enough money to counteract the corporate money flooding into our elections each year, rather than understanding that corporate money in our elections is neither legitimate nor inevitable, and striving to get corporations entirely out of our elections, something that very, very few of us are working on? Why else would we focus on trying to stop just one corporate harm at a time? One new big box store at a time, one new clear cut at a time, one new GMO product at a time, one new corporate stadium naming right at a time, one new coal export terminal at a time, rather than understanding that social and economic policy making by corporate boards is neither legitimate nor inevitable, and striving to get corporations entirely out of policy making, something that very, very few of us are working on. The Italian dictator Benito Mussolini once said, "Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is a merger of state and corporate power." It's pretty hard to argue with Mussolini on this one. We now live in a corporate state where government and corporations have merged, and things are going to continue to get worse and worse until we the people start hacking at the roots of this growing crisis, corporate constitutional so-called rights. I urge you to get involved by bringing this conversation to the groups you work with. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening. And remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Portland is predicted to have the second worst holiday gridlock in the country this Wednesday, second only to the Los Angeles car-addicted commuters. Historically, the last Wednesday of November is the nation's busiest traffic of the year, and according to INRIX, a Washington-based traffic analysis firm, we can expect up to a 35% increase in our commute time. Considering Portland's recovering economy, low gas prices, and geography, we may face conditions 15% heavier than last year. From 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., we will have the most congestion bottlenecking at I-5 North from McAdam Avenue to the Interstate Bridge.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Vernilia Randall, author of Dying While Black. Followed by Out Loud at 6, they will be joined by Rudith Rizzio, manager of volunteer resources at Cascade AIDS Project. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a 30% chance of rain. Patchy fog after 10 p.m. with a low around 51. Tomorrow, a slight chance of rain after 4 p.m. and a high near 59. Today in history. In 1783, the British left New York, their last military position in the United States during the Revolutionary War. In 1999, 5-year-old Elian Gonzalez was rescued by a pair of sport fishermen off the coast of Florida, setting off an international custody battle. And in 2002, President George W. Bush signed legislation creating the Department of Homeland Security and appointed Tom Ridge to be its head. The quote of the day is from Mumia Abu-Jamal. "You would think that a country that goes to war allegedly to spread democracy would practice in its own country."
It's 5:34, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
"Everyone from the Obama family in the White House to my little family in Texas will take a deserved pause from the unrelenting intensity of work on Thanksgiving Day. But millions will not get a work pause. Such workers as firefighters, police, and hospital workers must stay on the job, but they're providing essential services for our society. Yet Walmart, Target, Macy's, Radio Shack, and other retailers are also requiring their low-paid workers to report. Why? What's essential about buying gewgaws, gizmos, or garments from these mass marketers of consumer excess that justifies them forcing employees to give up this family day of Thanksgiving? Retail giants already exploit the day after Thanksgiving, which they've dubbed Black Friday, for an orgy of commercialism. Yet that's not enough to satisfy soulless profiteers, so they've moved their Black Friday start back into Thursday, during the family mealtime of Thanksgiving Day itself. Some are even opening their doors at 6 a.m. on Thursday, essentially wiping out this day of family grace for every employee they require to be at work. A mall outside of Buffalo has gone even more extreme, requiring its 200-plus stores to open on Thanksgiving Day or pay a $200 an hour fine. This is what Pope Francis recently condemned as unbridled consumerism. Yet a Walmart PR flack claims to be doing consumers a favor by staying open on a spiritual day to, quote, provide what consumers need. This is Jim Hightower saying, bovine excrement. Walmart has nothing that needs to be bought on a holiday, and any of the stuff it sells can be bought the very next day from Costco, Crate and Barrel, Barnes & Noble, Dillard's, Nordstrom's, Patagonia, and other stores that respect their employees and America's values by closing on Thanksgiving Day.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
An innocent unarmed man was shot and killed in Brooklyn last Thursday. According to the police commissioner, the shooting was just an accident. The victim, Akai Gurley, had done nothing to provoke the officer. The shooting occurred at a dimly lit stairwell while Peter Liang and another officer were on patrol. It's common practice for the Brooklyn police to make such patrols with their weapons drawn. Liang is a rookie cop with less than 18 months of experience. According to police statements, Liang was turning a doorknob with the same hand that was holding the weapon when it was discharged accidentally, killing Gurley. The medical examiner has ruled Gurley's death as a homicide, and Officer Liang may be charged. The Brooklyn District Attorney says the shooting was deeply troubling and warrants an immediate, fair, and thorough investigation. Mr. Gurley had spent the past hour getting his hair braided at a friend's apartment.
Marissa Alexander, the victim of domestic violence, facing trial in Florida for firing a warning shot, has accepted a plea deal. She will plead guilty to aggravated assault charges in exchange for 3 years in prison. She has already been in prison for over 1,000 days. She expects to be released in January. Despite the state's Stand Your Ground law and her insistence that she was in fear for her life, she was denied immunity twice. She says her husband was in a rage when she fired a warning shot into the ceiling. State Prosecutor Angela Corey contradicts Alexander, saying simply that Alexander did not fear for her life when she fired the gun. Even though nobody was injured, Alexander was facing up to 60 years in prison. And it's 5:38. We're going to hear from the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Joanne Powers. Hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in England and Northern Ireland held a 4-hour strike Monday, protesting government refusal to pay a 1% wage increase. The workers have had no pay increase for the last 4 years. Dave Prentice is the General Secretary of Unison, one of the largest of the 11 unions involved in the dispute.
Health workers have been told they do not deserve a 1% increase. This is absolutely crass, it's wrong, and it's meant that our workforces are demoralised. They're being kicked in the teeth by a government that won't even give them a 1% increase, which is in line with the government's own pay policy. It's immoral, it's wrong, and we're standing up for our members.
This is the second strike by NHS workers over the pay dispute, and more actions are planned throughout the upcoming week. UK Trades Union Conference General Secretary Frances O'Grady participated in Monday's actions in support of the health workers.
I think people are really worried that at the root of this, we've got a government that wants to privatise our NHS, wants to ensure that the workers have their morale destroyed, are paid less and less, walk away from the NHS, and we're saying no, enough is enough. People have to live, they have to pay their bills, they've got children to bring up. A 1% increase is in fact a real pay cut, but the government wants workers to put up with an even worse real pay cut, and it's not on.
On Thursday and Friday, Los Angeles and Long Beach port truck drivers, supported by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, ended 8 days of strikes against five employers who have now agreed to meet with union officials. The primary concern of the drivers is their misclassification by employers as independent contractors. International Vice President Fred Potter serves as director of the Teamsters Ports Division.
Most of them, they lease a truck from the employer. They have no independency at all. They can't drive that truck for any other customer. All their terms, conditions of employment, what they get paid, they have no say in. The hours to work, the loads they pull, they pay all the cost of operating the business, all the fuel, all the repairs to the truck. The fact of the matter is we have a number of these drivers who work 50, 60 or more hour week and ended up with a negative paycheck.
At the request of Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, the workers and the companies returned to the table for discussions the Teamsters Justice for Port Truck Drivers campaign characterized as productive. Potter says that as long as their meetings remain productive, the drivers will continue to work.
If those talks break down, we're going to use whatever lawful economic means we can use, including the right to go on strike. I don't like using the word never. It's all about negotiations. And where people are misclassified, we don't feel we have any latitude.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
A British human rights group has published a new report showing that for every drone strike the U.S. has carried out against an alleged terrorist leader over the last 10 years, there's been an average of 28 civilian casualties. The report was published by the group Reprieve and compiled by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The drone strikes in question were attempts to kill 41 alleged terrorist leaders. These strikes resulted in the deaths of over 1,100 people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. The U.S. has never declared war on any of these countries. Jennifer Gibson, the researcher who headed the study, said that drone strikes have been sold to the American public on the claim that they are precise. But she said that these strikes are only as precise as the intelligence that feeds them. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry claimed in 2013 that the U.S. only fires drones at confirmed terrorist targets after a great deal of deliberation and intelligence gathering. Over the last 8 years, there have been several attempts to eliminate al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri using drone attacks. In 2006 alone, there were two known assassination attempts, resulting in the deaths of as many as 76 children and 29 adults. Despite these U.S. drone strikes and civilian casualties, Zawahiri still remains at large.
In Mexico, protests continue over the kidnapping and apparent massacre of 43 students from a teacher college in the state of Guerrero. Since the students went missing, demonstrations have erupted in the capital, Iguala, across the country, and most recently in Zocalo Square, Mexico City. Last Thursday, there led a march through the capital city. Following the march, a group of masked youth clashed with police in Zocalo Square. 11 protesters were arrested after the clash, but human rights leader Fernando Rios said regarding those detained, "There is no evidence that they did anything other than attend the march. What we do know," he said, "is that police used excessive force as they cleared Zocalo." Of the 3 women and 8 men detained, most are students, including a 47-year-old Chilean doctoral student whose arrest has sparked protest in their capital city, Santiago. The 11 arrested protesters are being held in high-security jails hundreds of miles from Mexico City. A documentary called Presumed Guilty has come out, which highlights cases of systematic abuse in Mexico's capital city. One of the lawyers behind the film spoke about the recent march. She said, "It is very worrying that a march to repudiate crimes committed by police ended with more crimes committed by police."
A World Bank report has found that the world is already on an unavoidable course to global warming. The report found that even with very ambiguous goals for reducing carbon emissions, the world will see 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. That's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. With a 2 degrees Celsius rise, which the planet is on track to hit by mid-century, Brazil's soybean yield could decrease up to 70%, while melting glaciers will threaten cities in the region. Melting glaciers threaten Central Asia with torrential flooding as well. Thawing of permafrost in northern Russia threatens to unleash stored methane, contributing to a climate feedback loop. In the Middle East and North Africa, increased overall temperatures and more frequent heat waves threaten already scarce water resources. The report called for drastic and immediate reductions in greenhouse gas emissions to be able to leave the next generation a planet that still supports life.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, November 25th, 2014. Palestinian fighter killed in Gaza. Meanwhile, a Palestinian youth killed after being hit by a settler's bus in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.